Hard to believe that Science Friday's first broadcast was 25 years ago. That's right, this is our silver anniversary. And to commemorate our amazing journey, we're hosting a gala event on October 15th at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum here in New York City. It'll be a celebration of everything we've done for the past 25 years with special guests like Alan Alda, Brian Greene, and more. And you are invited. So head over to sciencefriday.com/gala to find out more and to reserve your ticket. You don't want to miss this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're coming to you from the Mondavi Center in Davis, California. And as we all know, California is bordered on the west by the Pacific Ocean. And as the globe is warming, seawater is becoming more acidic as it sucks in increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the air. Acidification can have dramatic impact on ocean life, from majestic coral reefs to the humble oyster. And as a result, oyster farmers have been facing tough times and falling production. Does this mean you may no longer get to enjoy your oysters? Will it be our appetite that you have to adjust? My first guest is studying ways to turn the tide in favor of oysters and other shellfish. Tessa Hill is an associate professor of earth and planetary science at the Bodega Marine Lab for the University of California, Davis in Bodega Bay. Welcome, Science Friday. We won't be taking calls today, but if you'd like to join the conversation, you can tweet us at SciFry or leave us a comment at sciencefriday.com. You know, we can talk about ocean acidification till we blue in the face, but why is this happening? Is it global warming that...
Well, it's a related problem. So as we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere through driving our cars or industrial activities, the ocean is a tremendous sponge for that carbon dioxide. About 25 to 30% of it goes straight into the ocean, and it fundamentally changes the chemistry of the ocean. It makes the ocean more acidic.
And what does that do for the shellfish? Why does that affect them?
Yeah, excellent question. So as the shellfish or corals or sea urchins, anything with sort of hard parts or shells, as they're trying to build their shell, they're pulling building blocks of their shell out of the seawater. And as the seawater becomes more acidic, there are less of those building blocks available. So they have a harder time making their shells.
And so how fast is this all unfolding?
It's tremendously fast, actually. The ocean is in direct contact or communication with the atmosphere. And so as we put things into the atmosphere, it essentially instantaneously changes the chemistry of the ocean.
Now, I know that you have a little demo.
That's right.
For how quickly this process can happen.
Right.
And apparently, I'm going to be a lab rat.
You are.
Okay,
yes.
Let's go do it.
You ready?
Okay. Yeah, let's go.
I find that oftentimes people find it hard to believe how quickly water can take up carbon dioxide and change chemistry. But it turns out, as we're all sitting here in this room and we're breathing, we are exhaling carbon dioxide.
Oh, you're filling up a beaker? No, first you're putting... Ooh, it looks like wine, but I'm feeling it's not wine.
So this is a pH-sensitive dye, and so the dye, the color of the dye ties with the acidity of the water. And so we have two of these. We're going to leave this one alone. It's this lovely dark red, almost purple color. I'm going to have you bubble your own breath into this one, and we'll see what happens.
So I'm doing a breathalyzer test.
To reiterate, please exhale.
Exhale, okay.
A little bit longer.
Easy for you to say.
You're welcome to stop if you would like.
Okay, I'm going to pass out now. Color changed. They went from a dark red to a cherry red.
Right. And we conveniently left an oyster shell here so we could talk about that.
Okay, tell us the significance.
Yeah, so this is essentially what's happening in the ocean on a regular basis. Just as this color change showed, so this might be an ocean before humans had an influence, and this is our current ocean. The current ocean is making it more challenging for things like oysters to make their shells.
Does it affect young, older oysters differently?
Well, we think it probably affects all of them, but we actually have a lot of reason to believe that larval oysters or baby oysters are particularly affected by this phenomenon.
Huh. And what about affecting the taste? of the oysters?
Ah, good question. That I know of, it does not affect the taste. But what it's affecting for oyster farmers, what it's affecting is their ability to successfully raise, you know, healthy oysters up to market size and actually be able to sell them.
So you go out and actually do research on the oysters? You go into the oyster beds? What's that like?
Yeah, so we do research in Tomales Bay at Hog Island Oyster Company, and we actually there are some fans here of the oyster company. We partner with them so that we measure what is happening right here, the process of ocean acidification, we measure right at the oyster farm.
What kind of water is it that you're working in? Is it freshwater, saltwater?
No, this is saltwater. It's in an estuary in a bay. So oysters are a species that likes to live in estuaries, so sort of where the land and the sea meet, where there might be a little bit of freshwater and a little bit of ocean water.
Mm-hmm. How does oyster farming work in general? How do you get an oyster?
You start with a larval oyster, which is what is on the left here, and these are actual images from a shellfish hatchery in Washington. That baby oyster floats around in the water for about a week, and then it settles onto a rock, or in the case at the oyster farm, it actually settles onto another piece of shell. And then they will raise it for up to a year or maybe even 2 years before they can sell it to you to eat. And what you're seeing up on this screen is the difference between a healthy, normally shaped baby oyster versus one on the right that has experienced these ocean acidification conditions. It's smaller and a little bit misshapen.
If the oceans continue to acidify at this pace, what does this mean for the oyster industry? Are they on the way out, or is it tougher to buy oysters, or what's going to happen?
Great question. I mean, I don't think they're on the way out, but I think that's because the oyster industry or the sustainable aquaculture industry as a whole has been very proactive in trying to address this problem. Yeah. And so they're really starting to take this problem into consideration in the way that they raise the oysters and the conditions where they raise the oysters. So they're building a lot of resilience to this issue. But I do think it has big implications for our relationship with the ocean, what we associate with the ocean in terms of our own recreation, our ability to eat seafood and enjoy the ocean is definitely going to be affected by this process.
So what is a farmer like a Hog Island Oyster Company going to do? Do they have to adjust?
Yeah.
Like how?
Well, so I can give you two examples. One is that with the information that we've been learning from Tomales Bay, they can make decisions about times that might be more stressful to put oysters into the bay. So maybe they would avoid time periods of the year that were particularly acidic, worse than normal. The other thing is they're actually building a brand new hatchery.
Oh.
And that hatchery is really taking this problem into account. And so they will have a state-of-the-art, you know, water chemistry lab in their hatchery to really think about how to monitor water chemistry and plan for the inevitability of this problem.
All right, we have someone at the mic out there with a question. Yes, sir.
Yes, with the baby oyster being so small in size to, I guess, the normal size, thinking about human development and how much occurs at the beginning of life, are the oysters able to regain that, what they've lost? Does it just take twice as long, or will, you know, we just have smaller, less tasty oysters forever?
Yeah, that is a really great question, and that's actually something we addressed directly with our research. So what we found is that if the baby oysters are exposed to these acidic conditions, even in that very narrow window of the beginning of their life, in the first week of their life, when they then settle on a rock and begin to grow, even months later, 4 or 5 months later, they have not caught up with the counterparts that were in the control group. So it looks as though that early life stage is particularly important for determining the health of the oyster.
Thank you. We have a picture up there.
Yes, and actually you can see in this picture, towards the bottom of the picture, there's a particularly rounded part of the shell. It's a little bit darker than the rest of the shell. That's actually the larval or the baby part of the shell. And then you can see that the shell sort of expanded outward, and that's when the oyster was basically a teenager. And we were raising them for months to watch as that shell accumulated in the later stages.
We know how difficult it is raising teenagers, so we will talk to you about
that's
that.
That's right.
Now, the plants are good at pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Can you do that in the oceans to pull the CO2 out of the water?
Yes. So I think there are some points of optimism in this story, and this is one of them, which is that there are some special places in the ocean that might actually help us fight this problem. One of them is in seagrass beds. Another example would be kelp forests. So these are much like the forests on land, that through using photosynthesis, they're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it. Seagrasses and kelp forests very likely do the same. And our research group right now is trying to actually fix some hard numbers on that. How much carbon do they take up and for how long?
That's interesting. Let's go back to the question in the audience. We have a young man out here at the microphone. Yes.
Does this affect abalone as well?
Wonderful. Yes, it does. We're actually, in addition to working with oyster farming partners, we also work with groups working to culture the red abalone. And they are very concerned about the future of the red abalone because of these conditions. And again, a point of optimism is that one of the things we'd like to do in that research is find strains of red abalone or places along the coast where you can find red abalone that are really resistant to these conditions. And so we're going to try to help the abalone farms actually find the abalone of the future.
Wow, that's great. Yes, sir. Step up to the mic, please.
I was wondering how much CO2 is actually needed to cause the acidification in the ocean, and what does that mean for other habitat in the ocean who are also experiencing this change?
Great question. So in terms of how much CO2, essentially the ocean stays in equilibrium with the atmosphere, so any amount that we put into the atmosphere, a fraction of it ends up in the ocean. And we are already seeing the effects of that. The effects are projected to get worse. And it will affect many habitats that you're used to hearing about. Coral reefs, kelp forests, mussels along the California coast. And it affects fish as well as invertebrates. So it's a pretty pervasive problem. It's also happening at the same time as several other issues in the ocean, like temperature warming and oxygenation change. So there's a lot of things changing all at the same time.
Well, Tessa Hill, thank you very much for
taking
time to be with us today. Associate Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences, UC Davis Bodega Marine Lab, Bodega Bay, California. Next up, lasers, planes, and a beetle invasion. And no, not the latest sci-fi thriller. It's a story of the California drought. Let me introduce our musical entertainment this evening, Joe Kai. And he's accompanied by Sacramento percussionist Brian Chris Rogers. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato at the Mondavi Center in Davis, California. Our next story has all the markings of a sci-fi thriller. We have high-tech planes swooping over a forest of giant wizened old trees, shooting lasers through the forest canopy. We have an army of exponentially multiplying unstoppable invaders, and of course our heroes, a band of scientists striving to save life from destruction. Except this really is not science fiction. It is a battle that is happening right here in California, and my next guests are two of the protagonists. You might think of them as Luke and Leia, so to speak, trying to save the forest from destruction. Greg Asner is an ecologist at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Stanford, California. Christina Restano is a research scientist at UC Davis, and she works with the California Fire Science Consortium. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Greg, you got to have one of the coolest jobs in the world, flying over these amazing places like Yosemite in a small plane.
Yeah, it's a good time. We try to work, but we have a good time doing it. What you see on the screen is a picture of my latest creation, which is the Carnegie Airborne Observatory 3. So we're in our third version. It looks like a simple aircraft, but on board there's some unique technology that allows us to measure the health and condition of forests. We have very high power computers and we have sensors that can read the condition of the forest.
So how do you read that condition? What are you doing to monitor? What kind of instrumentation do you have?
We do something unique called laser-guided spectroscopy. And what that's about is sending out signals of laser beams and reading those signals back, creating a 3D surface of the vegetation, and at the same time, critically looking at the chemical composition of that canopy. And today we measure up to 20 different chemical traits of these trees as we fly over, and we use those traits to diagnose, just like going to the doctor and getting a blood test, diagnose the health of every tree that we fly over.
And do you do this once a year or twice a year or different seasons?
Here in California, we're doing it once a year. We're doing an annual assessment, do an update on the state of the forests of California, and we do this all over the planet.
Wow. And Christina, while Greg surveys from the sky, I understand you like to be with your feet on the ground.
Absolutely.
What are you doing?
I like my feet to be on the ground as much as absolutely possible. What I do more is I walk around outside in the woods and I try to evaluate and survey the health of the forest, and then also try to look and see if any of the areas that have been thinned or burned to reduce the overall stand crowding and the density in the forest to see if that makes any difference. Unfortunately, what is happening is that these trees are overwhelmed by the combination of the water stress and the beetle outbreak. We have this overcrowding of the forest. There are too many straws in the cup, right? So we just have too many trees in a certain area, and then you combine that with warmer winters where the bark beetles are able to reproduce all winter long. In the past, the beetles would actually sleep in the wintertime and not reproduce because it was too cold. But as it gets warmer, now we have so many more beetles and we have so many trees in the forest. You combine those two things together and we have the current issue that we're facing.
Greg, as you're looking down, are you seeing the same kind of damage like this?
Oh, yeah. The rate of change in the last 5 years is amazing. What started out, here's a shot just from our cockpit, kind of hard to see on the screen, but that's a vast area, kind of central Sierras, mostly sugar pine in that area that have succumbed. And most of that happened in the last 12 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of the drought we're having out here?
Yeah, drought and the beetle combined. Yeah. Hmm.
And so you really, what you have is a double whammy that you're saying.
You absolutely do. So the trees themselves are not producing enough sap. So this is a key part of the whole story. So in order for trees to grow, they have to have water. It's a key part of the whole entire
That makes
key
sense.
Part. Exactly. And more. So you trees will first invest in their roots in order to get more water. They will then invest in their leaves so that they produce more of the factories that help them grow. They will then try to get taller and then to reach more light, then they will try to get wider, and then after that, they can invest in sap. So they have to cover their costs first, then they can invest in sap. Why is that important? Sap is important to push the beetles out. If the beetles are attracted to the stressed trees and they don't have enough sap, it gets pushed out. So I have seen some folks talking about, oh, I have had to cut so many trees in my yard. And, you know, everyone says, well, you can't use those for firewood. They've got too much pitch or sap. But not in this case. All the trees are bone dry. There is no sap. Mm-hmm.
If you have questions in the audience, we have our microphones out there. Please feel free to get up to them. And Greg, you make 3D models of these forests, right?
That's right.
What do they look like?
They're 3D models, but they're 3D chemical models. So what we're able to do is see inside the tree canopy, the foliage of the tree, and tell you how much water is in the tree, how much sugar and starch, we call that carbohydrates, and how much nitrogen is in the tree, and a lot of other chemicals. So my point of looking at this way is that we see the future. We see into the future in terms of which trees are really on their way out before we can actually count them as dead. And that number is massive in this state right now.
Let's see if we have a question out here. Yes.
Is there a way to, like, save a mass majority of the trees?
Can you save them? Yeah. What can you do to save them? And they're competing for each other with water, right? That you're saying that's, can we stop them competing somehow?
Well, I think that the trees that are already impacted, unfortunately, we can't do anything to save those trees, and you would agree with that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But I would certainly say that we have an opportunity to manage our forests by reducing the crowding and the density, and also promoting the use of wildfire and prescribed fire in forests. It's really in these ecosystems in the Sierra Nevada, fire is a natural part of the ecosystems here, and it has been excluded for so long that is why we have so many trees, because it used to be that the fire would come through and thin out the forest. It would kill some of the trees. We don't have that anymore, so now we have this problem. So we really do have an opportunity to thin and to use fire in a constructive way. And I'll let you add, Greg.
Yeah, well, our imaging is allowing fire management to think about where to put fire so that we can thin the forest and also do it in a way that's accommodating to the extremely dry conditions that we have. Probably don't want to put fire in some of the driest parts of the forest from the get-go. You probably want to do it in some of the areas that are crowded, just like we're talking about, but that aren't so wicked dry. And there is a lot of variation out there to manage.
I almost thought I heard you say that the beetles know how to find the sick trees. They have a beetle radar somehow?
This is actually really cool. So, well, I think because I'm a nerdy scientist, but trees, when the roots sense that it's very dry, they actually send a chemical signal to the tree to release a gas into the bole of the tree. By doing this, it reduces the overall content of water in the tree and tricks the tree to pull more water from the roots. That gas is a pheromone that attracts the bark beetles. So it's a very, that was actually one of the things that I learned as a student that made me say, I want to be an ecologist, because that's really interesting.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's self-destructive.
It is, but it used to be that worked out okay, because some of the trees would get stressed, some would then die by the beetles, and that was okay, because these beetles are a natural part of the ecosystem at endemic levels. But what we have now is it's an epidemic level because the warmer winters, the overcrowded forests, the very stressed trees.
Okay, let's take a question from over here on this side. Yes, sir.
Hi, I was wondering, have you been able to apply any of the new knowledge about the newly discovered wood wide web to helping trees?
The wood wide web.
So I think you are referring to Suzanne Simard's work, and where trees can actually communicate underground with their roots through the mycorrhizal, which is networks of mushrooms that are growing underground and helping trees access nutrients, which is really fascinating in and of itself. But I think that I'm not sure how we can utilize that in the management sense in order to better, that's really just a way that trees can access each other and the nutrients, but I'm not quite sure how we can tap into that tree communication strategy in order to help them through this issue.
Greg, do you have anything?
Yeah,
to add?
I mean, it's pretty hard to get water into the system if it's not coming in. I mean,
absolutely.
No matter how many tricks nature has invented, this new or changing climate system that we're in now, this regime, the last 10 years out of the last 14 have been drier than the long-term norm, and the last three have been the driest 3 years since 1895. So depending on how you look at it, is it long-term? The climate scientists are telling us this could be a long-term dry period for California that we're in now. We don't know. So as ecologists, I think we're trying to study the drought from the trees' perspective at different scales and then figure out management possibilities.
Can you tell from the snowpack of the year before whether there's going to be a drought in the trees or not?
Nowadays, we're not looking at snowpack to understand how the trees are doing and what they will do. We're looking at the tree chemistry to predict where they're going next.
And how good is that prediction?
I predicted the Forest Service showed 66 million this year, and I predicted about 60 million, so I'm plus or minus 10%.
That will
10%.
Die?
60, yeah.
60 million trees will die.
We already have
that
66 million dead
that's
trees
dead.
In the Sierra
So my prediction was accurate. Yeah. And that's based on tree chemistry before the death phase.
So he is able to show this, these trees will produce less sap.
Yeah.
That's essentially what he's able to show.
That's right.
With the complicated chemistry.
About a year in advance now.
Yeah.
We're getting towards about a year in advance.
That's amazing. Let's go to this questioner. Yes.
I have a question. I wonder if you guys know, it seems like CO2 emissions that, you know, is being caused by man is the major cause of the acidification that we see in the water, and then also now the destruction of all these trees. And I'm wondering, do you guys know what it would take to in order to bring down those CO2 levels such that we could maybe reverse the climate changes that we're currently causing?
I'll let you take this one.
Sure.
Go ahead. Hot one.
You asked the grand question. It's a matter of sequestering as much carbon dioxide as we can out of the atmosphere today. One of the cheapest, best, most efficient ways to do that is in forests. They store a lot of carbon. And thank you. And one of the other ways that but the main thing we got to do is start to decrease our emissions now. We can't be waiting and kind of dragging our feet. That's got to be something we do right now.
There you go. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Greg Asner and Christina Restano. Growing trees suck up a lot of CO2. Is it a folly to try to plant new young trees where the old ones are dying? Because they're going to, you know, be growing. Or are they not going to be growing? Or is this sort of just wasting your time doing that?
Well, I think that it's important to replant, but it's important to not plant in dense spacing. So that is something that happens a lot. Immediately, you know, we'll have these huge, big, gigantic wildfires. We'll have all of these trees die, and then folks will go back in and plant at very narrow spacing. And that is just, we are really trying to urge away from that, because we have learned now that if the trees are too dense, if you plant too close together and dense, we're just going to have the same problem. So you have to be really aware of how much you are planting. And it's important to think about the fact that, yes, trees are an important part of this process to sequester CO2, but we want to be sure to not plant so dense that they'll all just die again or burn in a wildfire. So you really have to balance that issue.
I would just like to add that Californians might need to think about the idea that we're going to be in a drier future, and that might change the species of trees that we have. So the density is critical. Exactly, about all those issues are totally right, but in addition, maybe the actual composition of our forests will change, and that means the type of trees that get planted.
So are the pines we're seeing, are they the ones that are most in danger?
Yeah, well, lately it's been sugar pines and ponderosa pine. Yeah.
And so what might we see taking over as they go?
Species that are more drought tolerant.
Like what?
There are chaparral species in California. There are oaks. There are different types of species that can handle the drier conditions. I don't know, maybe you know, whether some of those species can survive at higher altitude as well in colder conditions. Mm-hmm. And if not any of the ones we have in California, it might be others.
Yeah. All right, let's go. Which side? Let's go this side. Yes.
Hello. If you could make the best of a bad situation and turn the trees that are dying, like the 66 million trees that are pretty much dead, could you turn those into paper and like save some energy?
Yeah, so the species that are dying here are not commonly used for that type of a material, but they could be used for wood and lumber. One big problem that we have in California is our sawmills have closed. So there isn't anywhere to send the timber. So that has become a real problem, because we have more wood than we know how to handle. So we moved from overlogging our forest years and years ago to now underlogging them and not having the capacity to deal with that wood.
Mm-hmm. Let me get one more question over here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, as a follow-up to that, how do we create a demand for all this pine as a lumber product, and then how do we get incentives to burn some of it as waste for biomass to make electricity?
I like pointing at each other, too.
Well, that is a really good question and something that we're kind of struggling with as a... in this new world where we don't have the sawmills and where we have all of these trees that are dying, we are really struggling to figure out, honestly, how to use it. So I can't really answer that because I don't know.
Well, we'll answer that next time we're back here at UC Davis, because we've run out of time. I want to thank my guest, Greg Asner, ecologist at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Stanford, California, Christina Restano, research scientist at the University of California, Davis, who works with the California Fire Science Consortium. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Up next, we've talked about water, an animal that has adapted to living in a world without water. But first, once again, let's turn it over to Joe Kai and Brian Chris Rogers. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Mondavi Center in Davis, California. Now we're going to talk about life without water again, and that's not something we humans are capable of, and it's always the first thing that we search for when we go looking for life in other planets out in space. But there is an animal out there that's learned to survive in an environment that's all dried up. Maybe you've heard of them. They're called water bears. Isn't that cute? Yeah, it's a cute little animal, tiny. Tiny compared to other organisms in the world, scientists don't know. They don't know much about how water bears behave, or tardigrades, as they're called. They don't know what they eat or where they came from. But we do know one very special thing about this creature. They can survive without water for days or months, even years. They survive in a, I wish you could do that, I'll bet. They survive in a shriveled up little ball. They look like they're dead, but then you add a drop of water to them and they come back to life. My guest, John Crow, is a retired professor of molecular and cellular biology at UC Davis. And he figured out how the tardigrades do this way back in the late 1970s, and his curiosity all these years has changed the world of medicine forever. He's with us today and joined by Carl Johansson, a biology professor and tardigrade researcher from Fresno City College. Welcome to both of you on Science Friday. So, Carl, so we don't know a lot about tardigrades, but what we do know about them is really fascinating. Give us a quick tutorial. How were they discovered? How did we learn about them?
With the advent of microscopes, very quickly people took to looking at small samples, and they were originally reported along with rotifers and some other things as you put water. A lot of stuff collected off of roofs, and they would put them in
so
there.
So they're outside everywhere?
Yeah, they collect them off roofs, and then they saw animalcules. And they were just a curiosity for 300 years until... In the early 1920s, there was some a spurt of research on this ability to go, they didn't have a name for it yet, but we call it cryptobiotic, that they could essentially appear dead and then could be revived repeatedly.
Wow, and, for and years, then, for years at a time. They
yeah,
could.
Well, and there was one report of that being 120 years. When you track that report down, that's not accurate, but... It's not.
Fact-checking, we like that.
That's a story of science, of everybody repeating the same story over and over again without going to the original source. But we do know we had a case this year of 35 or 36 years documented that they've come back to life.
Now, I know you're going to give us a little demonstration about what happens when the water bear is out of water, but first you have a video of them dehydrating, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's see, look at it now. Tell us what's going on.
So what you're seeing here... the animal's crawling around, and then you see, and now he's essentially rolled up into that tun. But if you watch closely, you continue to see the dark mass shrinking. He's actively pumping water out of his system as he finishes up this cryptobiotic stage.
So he's pumping it out to survive. He knows he's in a state where there's no water, and he gets rid of all the water.
Yeah, the idea is if there is water, particularly if it's cold, if that water freezes, it destroys the cells.
I get it.
So they essentially have to get rid of the water. At that point, they either go, if they're doing metabolism, it's so very slow that it's almost impossible to measure. They must be doing something. But up until very recently, we could measure no cellular activity at all.
Right. Now, Carl, I know we're going to see if we can reanimate one or two of them or a few of them live right here on our stage.
Yeah.
Carl, let's head over. It's no pressure. I'll wait while you're doing that and seeing fine one. I'm going to talk to John. What a mouthful. Anhydrobiosis. What does that mean?
It means life without water.
Do other little microscopic forms do this, or is it just...
Many, many do. There's a misconception about tardigrades as if they were the only ones. No, there are many. Nematodes commonly do this. And we work with nematodes for many years because we can get a lot of them to do the chemistry. With tardigrades, you can't get very many. So we gave up on those about 40 years ago and turned to nematodes to study their chemistry. Ordinary baker's yeast, think about that. A packet of dry baker's yeast, you put it in water, those cells start metabolizing very quickly. Turns out their chemistry is very similar to the chemistry of anhydrobiotic tardigrades and nematodes and lots of other organisms.
So there's the sugar that you discovered.
It's a sugar that they synthesize. Many tardigrades require very slow dehydration, unlike the ones that Carl is showing you now. And during the slow dehydration, they synthesize a special sugar called triolose. It's a simple sugar. It's just two glucose molecules hooked together in a specific way. They have to stay hooked together for the molecule to work. Same sugar is found in yeast, the nematodes we studied, resurrection plants, on and on and on. The list is very long.
So when you made this discovery, what happened then? How did that change things?
Well, we began to ask, why is it there? What does it do? And beginning in the late 1970s, my colleague and by then my wife, Dr. Lois Crow, and I began to ask just that question. And we studied first model membranes. And we asked, what happens to a membrane when you dry it? Well, turns out that membranes have water all around them. That water is associated with the surface of the membrane, and if you take it away, it changes its physical characteristics in very damaging ways. Turns out the sugar replaces that water. It forms very weak bonds with the surface of the membrane and maintains it in the dry state in a physical state that makes it look like it's fully hydrated.
Hmm. So, Carl, how are we doing over there with our tardigrade, getting it to come back?
First thing you're going to see happen once you got the water on is the body starts to reinflate, starts to rehydrate. And so if you remember what it looked like when we first put it on the screen, it was tiny, like a crunchy little booger. And then
that's a technical term.
You're starting to see.
It fits.
It's science, man.
Use it. It's science.
What you see. The body's starting to swell, and you're starting to see some of the body structures that make it recognizable. Often we miss them when we look for them in the dried-up stage because they just look like a chunk of dust. But now you're starting to see some body features. I'm going to go back and refocus it and play with the light to get it.
Yeah, you can see it's actually stretched out. Yep. You can see some of the features of it. Let me ask you, John, while we're here. When did people start using these tree halos for medical application?
Began in the mid-1980s. Lois and I were at a meeting at Cambridge, and we talked about what we'd been doing with the sugar. And two food scientists came up and said, do you know what you have here? This could be very important medically and for food preservation and all kinds of things. So it started then. The first commercial products using triolose in a serious way were for pharmaceuticals. And the pharmaceutical is dried in a little serum vial. The physician gets a little vial with the drug at the bottom, dried, shoots in water and shakes it up, and it's ready to go. The first of those products was for treating systemic fungal infections, and it's still in use.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Carl, if I was going to look for tardigrades, where would I find them? Can I actually find them and put them under my microscope?
Yeah.
Look at them?
it's harder to make them revive than it is to find them. So we
well, look, they actually stretched out.
He's almost there. You just got to start moving, right?
Come on, move.
But you can find them. I mean, the most common place where we find them easily access is in moss and in on lichen. And they really are. They're an aquatic animal. They have to get their oxygen by absorbing it through their skin and get to all their cells. That's why they're so small. So essentially, that's why they have to go cryptobiotic. These guys live in the moss, in the thalli, in the leaves of the moss. When it's rain, it's wet, they're up and active, and they're moving around and eating and breeding. But when it starts to dry up, they sense that. And when the water's gone, they've got to be already rolled up and in their tun stage by the time that water dries up. And so for us, the easiest way to find them is just go out and collect dry moss, scrape lichens off a rock. We bring them back to the lab, dump some of that in a cup, throw some water in, and 2 hours, it's not hard. If my students can do it, you guys can do it. It's not hard. Yeah.
No comment about your students.
That's right. And a couple hours later, we just start sucking water out of there and putting it under, and we use essentially a dissecting scope at 2.5 power so you can see, and you just start scanning through, and when you start seeing movement, you start looking, and there'll be nematodes and rotifers and all sorts of neat stuff in there. But when you see an 8-legged clawed monster trying to move around, then you know you got him.
Well, there you look. You can actually see.
If you remember when we started, he's 3 times bigger than when we started.
Wow. You know, he looks a little, I think he's got performance anxiety up in front of our audience. Anybody have any idea? Okay, we have a couple of questions from the audience. Yes.
So humans have been fascinated with cryogenics to prolong life. Have people approached you to see if we could somehow have freeze-dried humans in the future?
Many, many, many times.
And what's the answer?
No.
Okay. No. Okay.
I want to get that on the record. When people first started talking about them, did they think you were crazy? I mean, you think they, come on.
Oh, yeah, this is weird science for a long time.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. It's not anymore.
But you kept at it. What kept you going? I mean, what made you so confident in what you were doing?
Absolute fascination with the whole idea. I first started working with these things when I was 15 years old. Yes. It was just after Sputnik, and the National Science Foundation was commissioned to go out and gather up promising high school students who wanted to do science. And I was one of them for 3 summers. And one of the summers, I read about tardigrades.
What is something that what don't we know about them that you would like to know now? And if we were to invest, I'm going to give you the blank check question I give to a lot of my guests. You could spend an infinite amount of money, and I have that check right in my back pocket right now. What would you invest in? What do you need to know or want to know?
A lot of what I'd like to know is getting learned right now. The triolose is not the whole story, for instance. We know there are stress proteins that are present that are especially important. There was a paper in Nature just last week to this point. Some Japanese investigators showed that there's a stress protein that inhibits oxidation in the dry state. So figuring out how all these stress proteins work is very important.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Carl Johansson and John Crow about tardigrades.
Can I say something real briefly?
Yes.
Because John's too modest. So when he started studying tardigrades, he got the same thing that I got when I started studying. Why are you studying those things? There's no money in it. There's no impact on humans. There's no economic gain. You're just throwing your career away. In my case, the answer is so. But John really had something to lose. he did. But he continued on, and here we are 40 years later, and as of this week, the stuff that John's doing turns out to be incredibly important for human health, transplants, all these kinds of things that are remarkable, right?
Well,
but it's all about, it's pure science, and we get that all the time, all the congressmen saying, oh, you can't be spending money to start the life cycle, this and that, that's stupid, waste of taxpayer money. That's what they would have been saying about John.
I have to explain to you what he's talking about. But human health, The Army approached us about 15 years ago and asked if we'd be interested in getting involved in a project on human platelets, platelet preservation. Now, you know what platelets do. They clot your blood. The platelets were and still are stored in blood banks for 3 to 5 days after which they're discarded. So there's a chronic shortage of platelets. And they asked if we couldn't use Trehalose to preserve the platelets. And yes, we can. We have them dried. They have a shelf life of at least 3 years in the dry state. Yeah. You add water and you get back fully functional platelets. That's in clinical trials right now. Hopefully, it'll be available to the general public in just a few years. The hope is that every soldier going into the battle will have in his backpack a little packet of his own platelets ready to go. Just add water and they're ready to go.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrific. I want to get into the weeds on this because it's really fascinating. What does this sugar do to make that work?
Well, first off, let's take it apart. It preserves membranes, as I said before, by replacing the water around the membranes. Does the same thing for proteins, does the same thing for DNA. All those main structures in the cell are preserved very nicely by that sugar. Now, it has special properties that allows it to do that. One of the reasons it works so well is that in the dry state, trehalose forms a glass. Think of window glass, and you'll get the idea. It's a semi-rigid structure that holds all the cellular components in their place. Sucrose, for instance, is much less good at forming a glass. Furthermore, sucrose, which is two simple sugars, the bond will break. Now, if you get the monomers, glucose and fructose in that case, they don't work. So the bond has to be stable. With trehalose, it's stable for decades.
Wow.
So that's one of the reasons it works so well. The bond is strong. It has a special glass-forming capabilities that make it stable in the long, long term. All this from studying tiny little tardigrades, yeah.
And thank goodness you didn't take Congress's advice. Because we know what their opinion is worth these days, right? Thank you. Thank you very much. John Crow, Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology, Emeritus at UC Davis. Carl Johansson is Professor of Biology at Fresno City College. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you. That's about all the time we have. Our heartfelt thanks to Rick Etchison, John Rena, Joe Barr, Constant Crawford, and Craig McMurray. Christy Ansakolowitz, Aaron Palmer, Jay Leto, Carolyn Wetzel, and all the great folks at UC Davis, Capital Public Radio, the Mondavi Center, and the Society for Environmental Journalists for making this wonderful evening possible. Thanks also to Joe Kai and Brian Chris Rogers and to our production partners at the City University of New York. And we can't forget our Science Friday staff, Charles Berquist, Rachel Bouton, Daniel Dana, Brandon Echter, Ella Fetter, Jennifer Fennick, Sochi Garcia, Sarah Goldfarb, Luke Raskin, Katie Heiler, Christopher Intagliata, Jen Kwok, Julie Liebeck, Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Annie Nero, Daniel Peterschmidt, Christian Scott, Christy Taylor, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. In Davis, California, I'm Ira Flato.